and I wanted them to feel secure. I reminded people again and again that the liberation struggle was not a battle against any one group or color, but a fight against a system of repression. At every opportunity, I said all South Africans must now unite and join hands and say we are one country, one nation, one people, marching together into the future. Chapter 115. May 10th dawned bright and clear. For the past few days I had been pleasantly besieged by arriving dignitaries and world leaders who were coming to pay their respects before the inauguration. The inauguration would be the largest gathering ever of international leaders on South African soil. The ceremonies took place in the lovely sandstone amphitheater formed by the Union Buildings in Pretoria. For decades, this had been the seat of white supremacy, and now it was the site of a rainbow gathering of different colors and nations for the installation of South Africa's first democratic, non-racial government. On that lovely autumn day, I was accompanied by my daughter Zinani. On the podium, Mr. de Klerk was first sworn in as second deputy president. Then Thabo Mbeki was sworn in as first deputy president. When it was my turn, I pledged to obey and uphold the Constitution and to devote myself to the well-being of the Republic and its people. To the assembled guests and the watching world, I said, "Today, all of us do, by our presence here, confer glory and hope to newborn liberty. Out of the experience of an extraordinary human disaster that lasted too long, must be born a society of which all humanity will be proud. We, who were outlaws not so long ago, have today been given the rare privilege to be host to the nations of the world on our own soil. We thank all of our distinguished international guests for having come to take possession with the people of our country of what is, after all, a common victory for justice, for peace, for human dignity. We have at last achieved our political emancipation. We pledge ourselves to liberate all our people from the continuing bondage of poverty, deprivation, suffering, gender, and other discrimination. Never, never, and never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another. The sun shall never set on so glorious a human achievement. Let freedom reign. God bless Africa." A few moments later, we all lifted our eyes in awe as a spectacular array of South African jets, helicopters, and troop carriers roared in perfect formation over the Union buildings. It was not only a display of pinpoint precision and military force, but a demonstration of the military's loyalty to democracy, to a new government that had been freely and fairly elected. Only moments before, the highest generals of the South African Defense Force and police, their chests bedecked with ribbons and medals from days gone by, saluted me and pledged their loyalty. I was not unmindful of the fact that not so many years before, they would not have saluted, but arrested me. Finally, a chevron of Impala jets left a smoke trail of the black, red, green, blue, white, and gold of the new South African flag. The day was symbolized for me by the playing of our two national anthems. Although that day neither group knew the lyrics of the anthem they once despised, they would soon know the words by heart. On the day of the inauguration, I was overwhelmed with a sense of history. In the first decade of the 20th century, a few years after the bitter Anglo-Boer War, and before my own birth, the white-skinned peoples of South Africa patched up their differences and erected a system of racial domination against the dark-skinned peoples of their own land. The structure they created formed the basis of one of the harshest, most inhumane societies the world has ever known. Now, in the last decade of the 20th century, and my own eighth decade as a man, that system had been overturned forever and replaced by one that recognized the rights and freedoms of all peoples, regardless of the color of their skin. That day had come about through the unimaginable sacrifices of thousands of my people, people whose suffering and courage can never be counted or repaid. I felt that day, as I have on so many other days, that I was simply the sum of all those African patriots who had gone before me. That long and noble line ended and now began again with me. I was pained that I was not able to thank them, and that they were not able to see what their sacrifices had wrought. The policy of apartheid created a deep and lasting wound in my country and my people. All of us will spend many years, if not generations, recovering from that profound hurt. But the decades of oppression and brutality had another, unintended effect, and that was that it produced the Oliver Tambos, the Walter Sisulus, the Chief Lutulis, the Yusuf Dadus, the Bram Fishers, the Robert Sobukwes of our time. Men of such extraordinary courage, wisdom, and generosity that their like may never be known again. Perhaps it requires such depth of oppression to create such heights of character. My country is rich in the minerals and gems that lie beneath its soil, but I have always known that its greatest wealth is its people, finer and truer than the purest diamonds. It is from these comrades in the struggle that I learned the meaning of courage. Time and again, I have seen men and women risk and give their lives for an idea. I have seen men stand up to attacks and torture without breaking, showing a strength and resiliency that defies the imagination. I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. I felt fear myself more times than I can remember, but I hid it behind a mask of boldness. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear. I never lost hope that this great transformation would occur, not only because of the great heroes I have already cited, but because of the courage of the ordinary men and women of my country. I always knew that deep down in every human heart, there is mercy and generosity. No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin, or his background, or his religion. People must learn to hate, and if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite. Even in the grimmest times in prison, when my comrades and I were pushed to our limits, I would see a glimmer of humanity in one of the guards, perhaps just for a second. But it was enough to reassure me and keep me going. Man's goodness is a flame that can be hidden, but never extinguished. We took up the struggle with our eyes wide open, under no illusion that the path would be an easy one. As a young man, when I joined the African National Congress, I saw the price my comrades paid for their beliefs, and it was high. For myself, I have never regretted my commitment to the struggle, and I was always prepared to face the hardships that affected me personally. But my family paid a terrible price, perhaps too dear a price for my commitment. In life, every man has twin obligations, obligations to his family, to his parents, to his wife and children, and he has an obligation to his people, his community, his country. In a civil and humane society, each man is able to fulfill those obligations according to his own inclinations and abilities. But in a country like South Africa, it was almost impossible for a man of my birth and color to fulfill both of those obligations. In South Africa, a man of color who attempted to live as a human being was punished and isolated. In South Africa, a man who tried to fulfill his duty to his people was inevitably ripped from his family and his home and was forced to live a life apart, a twilight existence of secrecy and rebellion. I did not in the beginning choose to place my people above my family, but in attempting to serve my people, I found that I was prevented from fulfilling my obligations as a son, a brother, a father, and a husband. In that way, my commitment to my people, to the millions of South Africans I would never know or meet, was at the expense of the people I knew best and loved most. It was as simple and yet as incomprehensible as the moment a small child asks her father, "Why can you not be with us?" And the father must utter the terrible words, "There are other children like you, a great many of them." And then one's voice trails off. I was not born with a hunger to be free. I was born free, free in every way that I could know, free to run in the fields near my mother's hut, free to swim in the clear stream that ran through my village, free to roast mealies under the stars and ride the broad backs of slow-moving bulls. As long as I obeyed my father and abided by the customs of my tribe, I was not troubled by the laws of man or God. It was only when I began to learn that my boyhood freedom was an illusion. When I discovered as a young man that my freedom had already been taken from me, that I began to hunger for it. At first, as a student, I wanted freedom only for myself, the transitory freedoms of being able to stay out at night, read what I pleased, and go where I chose. Later, as a young man in Johannesburg, I yearned for the basic and honorable freedoms of achieving my potential, of earning my keep, of marrying and having a family, the freedom not to be obstructed in a lawful life. But then I slowly saw that not only was I not free, but my brothers and sisters were not free. I saw that it was not just my freedom that was curtailed, but the freedom of everyone who looked like I did. That is when I joined the African National Congress, and that is when the hunger for my own freedom became the greater hunger for the freedom of my people. It was this desire for the freedom of my people to live their lives with dignity and self-respect that animated my life, that transformed a frightened young man into a bold one, that drove a law-abiding attorney to become a criminal, that turned a family-loving husband into a man without a home, that forced a life-loving man to live like a monk. I am no more virtuous or self-sacrificing than the next man, but I found that I could not even enjoy the poor and limited freedoms I was allowed when I knew my people were not free. Freedom is indivisible. The chains on any one of my people were the chains on all of them. The chains on all of my people were the chains on me. It was during those long and lonely years that my hunger for the freedom of my own people became a hunger for the freedom of all people, white and black. I knew as well as I knew anything that the oppressor must be liberated just as surely as the oppressed. A man who takes away another man's freedom is a prisoner of hatred. He is locked behind the bars of prejudice and narrow-mindedness. I am not truly free if I am taking away someone else's freedom, just as surely as I am not free when my freedom is taken from me. The oppressed and the oppressor alike are robbed of their humanity. When I walked out of prison, that was my mission, to liberate the oppressed and the oppressor both. Some say that has now been achieved, but I know that that is not the case. The truth is that we are not yet free. We have merely achieved the freedom to be free, the right not to be oppressed. We have not taken the final step of our journey, but the first step on a longer and even more difficult road. For to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. The true test of our devotion to freedom is just beginning. I have walked that long road to freedom. I have tried not to falter. I have made missteps along the way, but I have discovered the secret that after climbing a great hill, one only finds that there are many more hills to climb. I have taken a moment here to rest, to steal a view of the glorious vista that surrounds me, to look back on the distance I have come. But I can rest only for a moment, for with freedom come responsibilities, and I dare not linger, for my long walk is not yet ended.
izwaye mithandazo yetu kusi siyelela
siyelela
tina lusapho lwayo.
In 1993, Nelson Mandela shared the Nobel Peace Prize with F.W. de Klerk. For 4 days, beginning on April 26, 1994, the first national non-racial, one-person, one-vote election was held in South Africa. Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress polled 62.6% of the national vote.
The President-elect of the Republic of South Africa, Mr. Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela.
On May 10, 1994, Nelson Mandela was inaugurated in Pretoria as president of the first democratic, non-racial government of South Africa.
Will you please take the oath of office?
I, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, do hereby swear to be faithful to the Republic of South Africa and do solemnly and sincerely promise at all times to promote that which will advance and to oppose all that may harm the Republic, to obey, observe, uphold, and maintain the Constitution and all other laws of the Republic, to discharge my duties with all my strength and talents to the best of my knowledge and ability, and true to the dictates of my conscience, due to justice to all, and to devote myself to the well-being of the Republic and all its people.
Will you please raise your right hand and say, so help me God.
So help me God.
Afterward. Long Walk to Freedom closes at a time of profound euphoria, as Nelson Mandela was inaugurated president of South Africa. He and the liberation movements had overcome seemingly insurmountable odds and brought an end to apartheid. They had worked with their adversaries to guide a nation torn by violence into a new and peaceful freedom. South Africa had become the world's youngest democracy. Yet these hard-won triumphs were not the completion of Nelson Mandela's long walk. The ex-political prisoner and former revolutionary now stood at the helm of his nation. In many ways, the real tests of democracy, as well as the slow, difficult work of rebuilding a country, had only just begun. As president, Nelson Mandela worked diligently to repair the fabric of South African society, which had been ripped apart by inequity and hatred. Together with his longtime comrades and his former oppressors turned negotiating partners, he formed a government of national unity. He acted with tremendous respect toward former opponents and insisted on the inclusion of employees from the previous regime in his own administration. He also undertook countless personal acts of reconciliation that brought a visceral sense of liberation to the downtrodden and dispossessed, as well as to those who bore the guilt of apartheid or the isolation of unearned privilege. Nelson Mandela made it clear that the Rainbow Nation of South Africa was home for all its people, Zulu and Afrikaner, British and Xhosa, Indian and Ndebele, Malay and Tswana, Khoisan and Venda, Sotho and Pedi, Swazi and Shangaan, the colored people of mixed heritage, and all others. He invited everyone to the national table to sit together as equals, free from the nightmares of their collective past. He created progressive policies that brought historic, substantive change. Under Nelson Mandela's leadership, South Africa adopted a new constitution one of the most advanced in the world and the first to guarantee equal rights based on sexual orientation. He appointed Archbishop Desmond Tutu as head of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, empowering him to guide South Africa's citizenry down the arduous path of truth-telling, remorse, catharsis, and forgiveness instead of the road of revenge. Nelson Mandela became a source of pride and inspiration to South Africans of every color, to Africans across the continent, to black people throughout the diaspora, to oppressed people everywhere, and to millions more around the world. Globally, he became revered as a senior statesman, respected by people from all ends of the political spectrum. South Africa's hard-won miracle enabled people the world over to imagine new possibilities. If apartheid could end, if former enemies could negotiate a peaceful transition, what other conflicts and ostensibly intransigent problems might also be solved? Mr. Mandela's accomplishments made humanity's highest hopes seem achievable. The new nation on the southernmost tip of Africa, the continent believed to be the birthplace of all humankind, made a new world of equality and justice seem viable. Despite his triumphs, and after only 1 5-year term in office, Nelson Mandela declined to run again. This was an uncommon act in any country where a president is enjoying great success, but it was unprecedented in contemporary Africa. Ever the visionary, Nelson Mandela recognized the importance in setting an example of power willingly handed over to the next generation. He stood aside in order to help ensure that the democratic process took hold in South Africa, allowing the ongoing peaceful transition of leadership. Still, he remained active on the national and world stage as a moral voice for equality and peace and as a defender of human rights. He worked to improve the lives of the children of South Africa and provided essential leadership in the fight against HIV/AIDS, which had swept across the continent. South Africa soon had more people living with the disease and more children orphaned by it than any other country, and Mr. Mandela worked to stem the tide of the deadly pandemic. He raised money for impacted children and spoke openly about the importance of safe sexual practices. In powerful acts of solidarity aimed at fighting stigma, he donned a T-shirt emblazoned with the words HIV positive and stood alongside AIDS activists fighting for universal access to life-saving medicine. Nelson Mandela had become an archetypal figure. He exemplified the human quest for freedom and equality, as well as the most laudable of leadership traits, unwavering commitment, profound foresight, unflinching courage, power wielded with humility, tremendous dignity and generosity, a sense of humor even in the bleakest situations, a life lived in accordance with one's highest ideals. His name was invoked to represent the ultimate triumph of truth and justice, the willingness to sacrifice oneself for the larger good and the greater human family, and the capacity to genuinely reconcile with former enemies. Then, in 2004, Nelson Mandela announced his formal retirement from public life. He empowered three organizations, the Nelson Mandela Foundation, the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, and the Mandela Rhodes Foundation, to carry on his humanitarian efforts. Still, he was called upon continually to add his ethical voice and moral weight to crises and causes around the world. Finally, in 2008, at a concert in his honor, he sent a message to people across the globe, saying, "Even as we celebrate, let us remind ourselves that our work is far from complete. Where there is poverty and sickness, including AIDS, where human beings are being oppressed, there is more work to be done. Our work is for freedom for all. After nearly 90 years of life, it is time for new hands to lift the burdens. It is in your hands now." Nelson Mandela had officially passed the torch. If we are inspired by his life, if we are moved by his actions and sacrifices, then it is up to us to carry on his work, because the future he envisioned and fought for depends on us all.
Hi, my name is Amber Fairweather, and I am here with Richard Stengel, who collaborated with Nelson Mandela on Long Walk to Freedom. Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Richard Stengel, and I am the editor of Time magazine, and I also collaborated with Nelson Mandela on Long Walk to Freedom, which was the greatest experience of my life.
How did you meet Nelson Mandela?
I first started going down to South Africa and writing about South Africa in the mid-1980s. I had written a book about a little town in South Africa that was facing a forced removal, and the book was called January Sun. And when the publisher of Long Walk to Freedom was looking for someone to work with Mandela on his autobiography, he had read January Sun, and he called me and asked me whether I would be interested in collaborating with Mandela. And that is certainly an offer that no one can refuse, and I said yes enthusiastically.
Can you explain the process of working with Mandela on this book?
I had actually never met Mandela when I was hired to work with him, and I had to be vetted by the ANC, and that all went fine. And when I got down there at the end of 1992, I spent some time waiting to see him, and the first time we did meet was close to being a disaster because I had been frustrated in not seeing him, and he didn't realize how elaborate and long the project would be. And I said, if you think you can finish this project in a few weeks, you're crazy, at which point I was ushered out of the room. We saw each other again a couple of days later and made up, and that started the project. And so the idea was that I would interview him extensively about his whole life, and he would talk about his whole life from the very beginning to that moment in time when South Africa was creating its first non-racial democratic constitution and they were getting ready for their first true free election. The other big component of the book was what was known as his prison diary, which was a memoir, short memoir, about 15,000 words that he had written in the 1960s when he was on Robben Island. So I had access to that great document, which I believe should be published and is a great historical document on its own. So in combination with that document, with the many hours of interviews with him about his life, and also interviews that I did with people who had been involved in his life, people he grew up with, men he was in prison with, people in the ANC, that would form the basis of Long Walk to Freedom. We eventually did about 75 hours of interviews, which are now actually in the hands of the Nelson Mandela Center for Memory in Johannesburg, so people can listen to those and hear Madiba, as I called him. And it was a fantastic experience, and being around him is extraordinary. And I said to him, look, I know we need to do all of these interviews for the book, but can I just hang around even when we're not doing those interviews? And he said yes. And so for about 9 months while we were doing the interviews, I spent nearly every day with him.
So how long did it take?
It really, for a book of that size, and it's a big book, it really took a remarkably short amount of time. It was about a little over 2 years.
What I liked about the book is that it is a historical document.
In working on the book, both Mandela and I felt very keenly that it wasn't just an autobiography. It really was a biography of South Africa, and in some ways even a biography of the African continent and the quest for freedom. And I did a tremendous amount of research into the freedom movement in South Africa, which has deep, deep roots. And Mandela himself was a great student of that, a great student of the quest for freedom in Africa, going all the way back to early tribal stories that he heard as a young man about freedom fighters and warriors in South Africa in the 17th and 18th century. So there is a lot of that in the book. Its relevance for an American audience is, to me, simply that it's relevant to everybody. It has universal themes of forgiveness, of resilience, of strength, of leadership, of listening and responding. There were many, many, many lessons that I learned from him personally, and learned from writing about his life and understanding his life. And I think one of the things that the book does is that it's a great teaching story. And as I was working on it with him, I constantly wanted the reader to feel like, what would I do in this situation? How would I respond? And of course, we can't all be Nelson Mandela. He almost always responded with incredible bravery and generosity in situations that most regular folks could not have handled. But I think one of the things the book shows is just that people do have that capability. And if you keep calm, if you stay rational, if you keep a set of core beliefs, then you too can achieve in your own life something that mirrors in a way the great achievements of Nelson Mandela.
I like too that during this whole time, he didn't accomplish this in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, even 20 years.
Yes, I mean, one of the mottos that I took away from it and have written about too is it's a long game. He's playing a game that lasts decades, even centuries in a way. And that's, he thinks in terms of deep time, not just in terms of the first or second hand on your watch. Because there's a man who was in prison for 27 years who never stopped thinking about what he would do when he got out of prison. For him, it was a very, very long game. And he played it such that he knew it could come out well in the end if he remained patient.
What advice would you have for people who want to be more aware of the world in a more truthful way?
Remember, America, England, pretty much the entire what constitutes the European Union today, who were all colonial powers once upon a time, supported white South Africa, supported the apartheid government of South Africa, who were hunting Nelson Mandela down as a terrorist. And he was considered a terrorist by the FBI, by the CIA. So we think of people as not helping them. He spent, before he was finally arrested, he went on a kind of grand tour to Africa and other places seeking support. And he did get support. He got support from the old Soviet Union. He got support from Cuba. He got support from Libya. He got support from other African countries that were undergoing transformation. So there was support for the movement, but it was supported by people who, during the Cold War, were on opposite sides with the West and with America and Europe. I think one of the things that Mandela's story does is it helps you look at the world and think today's villain can be tomorrow's hero and today's hero can be tomorrow's villain. And he was fighting for something that we today take for granted as something which is a universal truth. Individual freedom, freedom of thought, freedom to vote, freedom to choose your own system of government, equality among all the races. But at that time, it wasn't so universal. And of course, a country like South Africa didn't have a declaration or a constitution like ours. And in fact, it had to be invented. One of the things that Mandela's story does is it helps people to look at the world and think, let's not just look at this in a cut and dried, simplistic, received wisdom way. Let's look at what the values are that nations and national leaders have and try to evaluate it based on what you think is right and what you think is wrong. It was a fantastic experience being with him and working with him because you do try to embody and contain those ideas, and it makes you, frankly, a better person when you do that. I wish I could say I always did that and was able to always internalize those ideas. But some of those notions, one mentioned before about it's a long game, about being patient. His generosity was something that we can all learn from, but it was also something that he understood that was in his own interest to be generous to people, to forgive the white South Africans who imprisoned him and kept him behind bars for all those years. There are lots of leadership lessons. There's a very familiar one, which is leading from the front, which you think of him as doing. He was a great physical, passionate, spiritual leader, but he also led from the back. He let everybody speak and give their opinion before he weighed in. He wanted to empower people to feel like they could lead in his stead, which is part of his generosity and part of his practicality.
What are some of the obstacles that you faced while working on this book?
Well, one of them is I never got to see him as much as I wanted, and he while we were working on this book, it was a very, very turbulent time in South African history, and it was the lead up to their first elections and to the creation of the Constitution. There was a genuine threat of civil war from the parties on the extreme right. There was a lot of violence going on in the country at that time, and Mandela was a source of stability. There, while in the middle of working on the book, Chris Hani, the leader of the South African Communist Party, was assassinated. Mandela actually was the one, rather than de Klerk, the president of South Africa, who went on television to calm people down. So even while we were working on this book, he was basically bringing his own nation together and keeping it stable. And it really was extraordinary to be able to see that. One of the obstacles was just he had a lot more important things to do. And I would spend these days with him, and there would be days where he just said, look, we don't have time to talk today. We also did the interviews. He's a very, very, very early riser. He gets up at 4:30 in the morning, and we would do a lot of the, I wasn't then an early riser, but we would do a lot of the interviews at 5:30. I think it was great for him because he was the most lively and awake that he would be all during the rest of the day at those hours. He loved being up early in the morning. And then, of course, there were obstacles that, because South Africa was still in the middle of this transition, he, I think in many ways, or certainly in some ways, was more circumspect about things going on in South Africa, people in government, than he might have been once he knew there would truly be a new democratic dispensation.
I'm curious to hear your perspective about South Africa now.
I think South Africa is a remarkable success story. When you look at what could have happened, and I know that Mandela himself felt the country was teetering on the brink of a civil war. When you look at that nightmare scenario and then what it turned out to be, it's really a remarkable transition and transformation. He was, of course, the first president of a new democratic South Africa. One of the things that he realized was that South Africa had to have everybody feel like it was their country, white and black, colored and Indian. And he reached out to every group. He wanted every group to feel a part of this new rainbow nation. In many ways, that could be even his greatest achievement, that he kept the country together. Even though there are lots of problems, they have very high HIV rates, they have very high unemployment rates, he basically kept the country intact, kept the economy intact, and I think it's a country that really works, that is growing, that is a good place for investment, a good place for tourism. And I think that is his great legacy. I think somebody who does listen to the entire book really does get this very 360-degree look at not only Mandela's life, but modern South African history.
Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
This has been an Hachette audio production of Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela. Written by Nelson Mandela. Read by Michael Boatman. Produced and directed by Amber Fairweather. Recorded by Tommy Herron. Post-production by John Colucci. Foreword written by Kofi Annan. Afterword written by Sharon Gelman. Special thanks to language advisors Gloria Mosia and Sonovision Studios. Long Walk to Freedom is also available in print and as an ebook from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 1994 by Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela. Audio production copyright and published 2011 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.